Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Prime Minister Tony Blair arrives tonight at President George W. Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas. Publicly, the two leaders are still standing shoulder to shoulder, but the ground beneath Tony Blair is shifting, and shifting away from Washington. In the war on terror, Britain has been one of the United States' staunchest allies, thanks largely to Blair. He sent the largest deployment of British troops since the Gulf War into Afghanistan and has hinted that he will back U.S. military action in Iraq. But as the crisis deepens in the Middle East, members of Blair's own Labor Party have become increasingly critical of his unwavering support of Bush war plans. And just beyond Britain, Europe is seething with opposition to America's tough new view of the world. This weekend at the Bush Ranch, can even Tony Blair bridge the widening gap between U.S. and European opinion on the war in Afghanistan, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and the question of war and Iraq? Julian Borger is U.S. correspondent for The Guardian. He's reporting from Crawford, Texas. Good evening and welcome, Julian Borger.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Julian, has the Prime Minister landed? Is he in Crawford, Texas yet?
Yes, that's right. He arrived about an hour ago, and he's at the ranch in Crawford.
And what's at the top of Tony Blair's agenda as he sits down with President George W. Bush?
I think at the top of his agenda is an attempt to smooth the differences between Europe and the U.S. on what comes next in the war on terrorism. I think there was a fair degree of consensus in the first stage when it came to Afghanistan, and a great deal of dissent in Europe and in particular Britain when it comes to what should happen in the second phase, particularly Iraq and particularly against the backdrop of what we're seeing in the Middle East in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Tony Blair has been seen as a rock of support for the United States on the other side of the Atlantic by Americans. Does he remain in a position to offer that kind of unqualified support?
No, not at all. Very much, when we talk about this second phase, that support has got political ramifications for him at home. I think it was clear that the Blair government was prepared to back the Bush administration when it came to Iraq before this most recent explosion in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I think that explosion revealed how tenuous the grip on power of some of the moderate Arab regimes are in the Middle East. And I think there was great concern in the Blair administration that should the Bush and the Blair government, that should the Bush administration push ahead with Iraq in these kind of circumstances, you could see a domino effect in the Middle East. You could see Jordanian government and the Egyptian government, both long-term British and U.S. allies, coming under extreme pressure from their own populations and from Islamic radicals, and the picture of the Middle East changing radically.
Tony Blair, like his old friend Bill Clinton, is known as a good talker, as a smooth talker. Will he be fully candid with George W. Bush about the degree of opposition to American policy in Britain and in Europe?
Well, if you talk to British officials, this is what they say is a great advantage of the Blair relationship with George Bush. He came under criticism at home and, you know, being denounced as Bush's poodle and all this. But British officials say the great advantage of being close to Bush is that when the British government feels that it has the point to make, it can make the point from the point of view of friends rather than European states wagging the finger at the Bush administration and being rejected for that reason. They feel that Britain, in this sense, and the phrase they use is punches above our weight, that we can have influence that goes beyond the relatively small nature of our nature of the British economy and diminished standing in the world because we retain this close relationship.
This weekend was supposed to be all about preparing for war with Iraq. Do you think that President Bush will welcome Tony Blair's tutelage on instead, or primer, on European unease or unhappiness?
Well, I think they've really built European unhappiness into their calculations in the Bush administration. I think, though, British unease is going to have a much more profound effect, because I think the Bush administration, since September 11th, has more or less taken British support for granted and been able to point to British support when accused of unilateralism. Right. They said, well, we do have close British support, and we are a coalition. Now, if even Britain is having second thoughts, and even the Blair government is having second thoughts, then I think that does get through to the Bush administration.
Those second thoughts appear to be giving Tony Blair some new political trouble at home. What does Prime Minister Blair need to bring home from Crawford, Texas, to say to critics in Britain that he's making headway to shore up his political base in his own country?
Well, I think he's already been able to show, or at least point to, a dividend that he's obtained from the relationship he's cultivated with George Bush, because of the Bush declaration we saw on Thursday on American policy in the Middle East. Britain has been pushing hard for U.S. re-engagement in the Middle East in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and the British officials were yesterday pointing to that Bush declaration as in part a triumph for that policy, because they've been pushing for it hard and said you cannot push ahead with a confrontation with Saddam Hussein while leaving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to unravel the gains that have been made in peace in the Middle East over the last generation.
So, in a sense, among its many effects, the Rose Garden speech by President Bush this week has eased the way for a more comfortable meeting with Tony Blair.
Yes, there was a great deal of concern running up to this meeting that it was going to do a great deal of damage to Tony Blair back at home, and that he would somehow have to choose between this close relationship and the appearance of being a good buddy of Bush and losing ground at home politically because of great concern about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. A lot of those concerns were lifted by the Bush declaration on Middle East re-engagement, and there was great relief in the British embassy and among British officials in general.
What else do you think Tony Blair would like to hear from George Bush, or to have George Bush say publicly this weekend to help him with his home constituency?
Well, I think of a further movement of the U.S. along those lines about what the U.S. plans are in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I think they would like to see signs that the Bush administration is prepared to sustain its engagement, because it's clear that there's going to be they're really walking onto a minefield. There is going to be more bombings. There's going to be further Israeli incursions. And the question is, will Bush stay the course? And I think that's what Tony Blair is going to be looking for, a sense that this is now a new commitment of the Bush administration to be involved in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the Israeli-Palestinian relationship on the long term.
Julian Borger, thanks so much for joining us this evening. Julian Borger is correspondent in the United States for The Guardian. When Tony Blair sits down with George W. Bush to share some Texas barbecue this weekend, he'll have some deep dissent in the UK and Europe to explain. How do you account for the growing gulf between the United States and its old European allies? Who's seeing clearly here and who's not? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me now from New York is British journalist and historian Jeffrey Wheatcroft. He's author of The Controversy of Zion, Jewish Nationalism, the Jewish State, and the Unresolved Jewish Dilemma. Good evening and welcome, Jeffrey Wheatcroft.
Good evening.
Also joining us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack. Are you there, my good Jack Beatty? I'm sure Jack will join us in a moment. Jeffrey Wheatcroft, you are in the U.S. right now, but you have a strong finger on the pulse of British public opinion. Can you give us the background to Tony Blair's arrival in the U.S. today? What situation is he facing at home? We've seen his shoulder-to-shoulder support of the U.S., even sitting in the well of the U.S. Congress nearly last fall after the 9/11 attacks. What is the situation that he has to be mindful of in Britain as he sits down with George W. Bush?
Well, it's very interesting because in some ways, Blair, since September 11th, has become something of public hero, as I gather. This is my first visit to America since September.
A public hero in the United States.
In the United States.
No doubt. When President Bush gave his famous speech in September and Blair was there in the balcony, it brought to mind a grand and old alliance.
That's right. And yet at the same time, since September, in the immediate aftermath of September 11, there was a great widespread sense of sympathy and support for the Americans in England and in continental Europe as well, which has to some extent dissipated. And what Julian was saying a moment ago was absolutely true about how not only is there a great unease across Europe. I mean, it is extraordinary to come here at the moment and to compare it with not only my own country, but with Europe in terms of public opinion, because there has been a very, very strong mounting tide of anti-Israeli opinion throughout Europe. That is simply an objective fact, whereas that is not, of course, true here. In England, it is exactly true, as Julian Borgia was just saying, that almost no one inside the government, as a matter of fact, let alone outside the government, thinks that there could possibly be any kind of attack on Iraq while the present conflagration is going on in the Holy Land. But the only thing I would add to that, to what Julian said, is that even before the latest horrible explosion of violence between Palestinian suicide bombers and then the Israeli retaliations, even before that, this question of Iraq looked like being something which, for the very first time in 5 years of Blair's prime ministership, could threaten his position. He carried his government and his party when he said, "We stand with the Americans and we will send our own guys into Afghanistan." But I wasn't at all convinced, even before, as I say, the bloodshed, the latest bloodshed in and about Jerusalem, that Blair could carry the Labour Party and his own MPs in Parliament and possibly many of his own ministers.
So how serious is it?
To support an American attack on Iraq?
Could he?
That was before the latest explosion
and the Israeli incursion into the West Bank and the Palestinian bombings. Could Blair find himself facing a vote of no confidence at some point over his support of U.S. policy?
This is the first time since Blair. I mean, he has had this astonishing political success. First of all, really taking over the Labour Party from the inside and then winning one and then two landslide general elections and walking very tall indeed in political terms, despite an undercurrent of resentment within his own party throughout, to a degree which it's quite difficult to explain to Americans, I find. But anyway, there was no way, it seemed, that his own position could possibly be threatened.
And now?
But then, in 1990, remember, Margaret Thatcher had won three general elections, something that hadn't happened since the Great Reform Bill of 1832, and had a clear large majority in the House of Commons. And she was effectively deposed by her own Tory backbenchers. And though I wouldn't say that was going to happen to Blair in the immediate future, it means that such a thing can happen. And he has, I think, run up against one question, which is more than any other likely to threaten his real command of his own party.
And that question is the support.
That is Iraq. I mean, there is very little support in England for a military attack on Iraq. And that's true, really, on the right as well as the left. I mean, everyone knows that Saddam Hussein is a murderous dictator. But even commentators who are deeply sympathetic to Blair have been saying, look, hold on, this is one step much too far. You mustn't do it. And they have all been advising him, and I'm sure this has also been true in the cabinet, or at any rate what passes for cabinet discussions nowadays in London, that people have been saying to Blair, look, you've got to cash in your chips. This is really what Julian was saying a moment ago, but in almost a more emphatic way. You have acquired this bank of credit in Washington since September, and now you've got to use it by telling the Americans that they simply must not embark on this crusade against, or whatever we're going to call it.
That's or whatever word we're going to put
on. Meant to be an unfortunate word nowadays, against Iraq.
Mm. And Jeffrey Wheatcroft, we've got to take a short break. Please stand by. There's so much we want to dig into with you. We're talking about Tony Blair, Britain, and the Europe that says no to America. What do you think of Europe's mounting dissent? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Tony Blair, who is now in Crawford, Texas, soon to be with President George Bush, about Tony Blair, Britain, and the Europe that increasingly says no to America on many fronts surrounding the war on terror. We're joined by Jeffrey Wheatcroft. He's a British journalist and historian. We welcome you as well. What do you think of Europe's mounting dissent? Should they get with the American program, or should we listen to theirs? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I think we have Jack Beatty with us now from Hanover, New Hampshire. Jack, are you there?
I'm there. Hi, Tom, and hello, Jeffrey. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, Jack. Jack, you've heard some of what Jeffrey is alerting us to. It's amazing. We live in the global information age, and still an entire nation can live in a bubble. How serious do you see the disparity in worldview between Europe, the UK, and the U.S. right now, Jack?
Well, it sounds like it's stark, and it's a matter, really, of who speaks for reality, I think. There's a heavy dose, or there has been a heavy dose, of ideology, of sort of a priori feeling about the world in the Bush administration, coming strongly from the Pentagon, that things are supposed to be, that reality is this, and these other people are supposed to come around to our view, and that the center of our reality is the menace of Saddam Hussein. Well, other people don't see him as quite that big a menace, and they don't see him as necessarily part, a sort of ineluctable part of the war on terror. There is the war on terror, but that refers to Al-Qaeda. And then there is the danger of Saddam. President Bush has conflated them, and I think our European friends are saying, well, they're not necessarily conflated. And to try to do that by making war on Saddam might even worsen the situation with Al-Qaeda. So, you know, for years the American right has said that our allies are brakes. They act as a brake on our ambitions and our unilateral impulses. And I think we're seeing that. They are acting as a brake. And many Americans, I think, would say good thing.
We'll talk about how active, how effective a brake that is. But, Jeffrey Wheatcroft, I want to put to you, Julian Borger just told us from Crawford, Texas, that he expects Tony Blair to try and smooth over, as he said, smooth over the differences between views on this and that side of the Atlantic. Are these differences that can be smoothed over any longer?
Quite a lot of them aren't, I think. Tony Blair is in some ways very well placed to do this. He has got, it is traditionally, it's a weakness of the British position, but a great strength at the same time, that we are inevitably, for historical reasons, between Europe and America. That doesn't necessarily mean the metaphor of the bridge doesn't necessarily apply, but there is a role that Blair can play in that respect, and especially at the moment, because we've been saying that he has got capital in the bank with the Bush administration. There are such deep divisions between Europe and America, and they are widening the whole time, that it's going to be very difficult. And Blair, though he's a very remarkable politician, has a strength which is also a weakness, which is his tendency to tell any given audience what it wants to hear. And he has difficulty when he's talking to George W. Bush or the British electorate or the Ulster Protestants or the Ulster Catholics or whoever it might be, in actually honestly addressing and saying, look, there's a limit beyond which, you know, we have to face up to reality, and we can't just. His tendency, as I say, is to try, and to some extent, ingratiate himself with any audience. The bad effect at Crawford and thereafter, of tending to brush over the differences between Europe and America.
Mm-hmm. I must say, when I read what comes out of much of the British press and British journals and compare it with what I hear from Tony Blair, at least what we get here in the United States, it looks to me as though he might even be seen by history to have or to be being misleading the United States about what people are really thinking over there. Jeffrey Wheatcroft, at the top of the hour, you said that you, just coming into the States, are struck by the gulf in perspective. Here you are, just off the boat, just off the jet. Give us a sense, because you might be surprised by how little sense of the European view of the world and what's going on right now Americans have. Give us a sense of that gulf. What are the dimensions? How starkly differently do British and European observers see the world?
I'm increasingly coming to think, you know, we had this phrase which came back into vogue last September about the conflict, the clash of civilization, mm-hmm, was it? The Huntington thesis.
Yes.
Which means between, the implication was that it was between Islam and Christendom, or East and West, or possibly in the Balkans, between Eastern and Western Christianity. But I think that almost the most important clash of civilizations bubbling up at the moment is between Europe and America. And it comes in... It's not simply a cultural question or a political question or political questions. I mean, all the things we've been talking about illustrate in different ways this huge gulf, a widening gulf.
What's the nub of it?
The Europeans don't think that we should. Very few European. I don't think there's a single European government today which thinks it wise for the United States to attack Iraq for all sorts of different reasons. There are even European politicians like Chevènement, who is running at the moment for the French presidency and just could possibly give a fright to the other two, the two leading candidates. Mm-hmm. And he's a sort of interesting patriotic left-wing come right-winger. And he, I mention him because he, even at the time of the Gulf War, said that in the old French Jacobin tradition, that even if Saddam Hussein wasn't a particularly nice guy, at any rate he was secular. And we should cultivate him for that reason, as opposed to the crazy Islamists. Then you have a question between Europe and America, like capital punishment, which until recently has merely been a kind of vexation. Mm-hmm. And the Europeans think that the Americans, or some Europeans, or many Europeans, think the American love of capital punishment is barbarous. And the Americans think that Europeans are patronizing and interfering. But even that has political implications. When Ashcroft said that he was going to demand the death penalty for this guy who was...
French passport holder.
Who wasn't even at liberty on September the 11th as a member of a conspiracy. Mm. He's a French passport holder, and the result of that is of Ashcroft's intransigency over that is that the French are not going to cooperate. They won't provide any evidence because they think he might be put to death. And then there is, I was going to say, as well. I mean, it's almost the most important thing of all. What we tend euphemistically to call the Mideast, meaning the terrible, great conflict between the Jews and Arabs in the Holy Land. And there, it's quite hard to exaggerate, especially when trying to explain this to an American audience, how deep the gulf is and how hostile opinion in Europe is to the Israelis and to their American sponsors.
We want to dig into that and actually all of these in a moment. But, Jack, I want to bring you in here first on Jeffrey Wheatcroft's remarkable observation that the real clash of civilizations may end up being between the United States and its NATO allies.
Well, that's passing strange, isn't it? There is an ironic element, though, in this, especially in the Europeans' criticism of Israel and of the United States' alliance with Israel and in that part of the region. You know, a good deal of American history in the 20th century has been cleaning up after the messes of European colonialism and being pulled in Indochina and the Middle East and elsewhere to maps that were created by British and other statesmen in sometimes with conflicting promises to conflicting groups. And so here we are again, picking up the Europeans are criticizing us, and we're involved really in messes that in some way go back to their great centuries and their the era when they were meddling with the world on a large scale. So they're going to be very moral and wagging their finger at us, but we're partly dealing, as we have been throughout American foreign policy since the war, with the residue of European colonialism.
So, Jack Beattie, are you telling Jeffrey Wheatcroft to stuff it? They made the mess?
I don't think Jack would want to say that to me.
No, I would never say that.
David, Jeffrey Wheatcroft and Jack, stand by. David is on the line. Welcome, David. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. How are you this evening?
Very well, thanks.
The point I wanted to make is that I think there's a lot more sympathy in this country for the European view than we acknowledge right now, and that views inside our own country that are sympathetic to the European view are kind of cowed. You know, there's a huge gulf between Crawford and Europe, but the Atlantic is not what's dividing those views. Maybe it's Worcester or the real difference is between a cosmopolitan view of life and this kind of American nativist circle the wagons ideological view. Mm-hmm. And the gulf is even you could even focus in on this own, our own administration, where hopefully Colin Powell is now winning the ideological debate. And I think if Colin Powell were in complete control of our foreign policy, there wouldn't be this whole gulf between us and Europe.
David, you've got our wagons circled, and you make a good point. Let me put it to Jeffrey Wheatcroft and ask you, Jeffrey, do Europeans, do the British make distinctions or see distinctions between factions within the Bush administration on these issues?
Well, very much so. And without being a finger-wagging, patronizing European, it's been quite difficult the last...
Okay, you've got the microphone.
It's been quite difficult the last 2 weeks to say what the Bush administration's policy on the Mideast was, because it really did, if one followed it at all, it seemed to fluctuate not so much between factions within the White House or the State Department and the Pentagon, but it oscillated day by day. I mean, the United States supported the United Nations resolution, I think it was a week ago today. And then, over the last weekend, President Bush made statements which seemed to dissociate himself from a UN resolution which his administration had supported. Mm-hmm. And then so it went on until the latest specific statement by the president. There's very much a feeling in Europe that that Colin Powell represents a little foreign policy of his own, which many people would like to see him pursue more successfully and more actively. And there's also a sense, which I didn't want to exaggerate this, but that there may even be ignoble motives behind this in Europe, but there's a feeling that the Bush administration's policy on Iraq, for example, is irrational in the sense, for a variety of reasons. And the president is said, I don't know with what justice, to harbour a grievance against Saddam because his own father, the last president Bush, failed to get rid of Saddam in 91, and then Saddam is still there, and the elder Bush managed to lose the next election. There's also a feeling that within the Bush administration there are a number of very committed neocon ideologues with agenda of their own, and that they're not pursuing a sensible realpolitik over this. And to go back, I do think that, as I say, the one thing which unites absolutely everybody at the moment on the other side of the Atlantic is the view that it would be complete insanity to do anything at all about Iraq while the conflagration rages Israelis and Palestinians.
Jeffrey Wheatcroft, if we can maybe get to something like the heart of this, or at least a powerful American view that goes beyond the neocon group you're talking about, which is the U.S. has been attacked. It's a signal that the world needs to wake up, that there's a global problem of terrorism, and it is time to go out and relentlessly, with all the military force required, knock heads until the world lines up in opposition to terror and behind an agenda palatable to the United States. Do you see the Europe perceiving the depth of that point of view in the United States? And what does the UK make of that perspective?
Look, I think the answer to that is that there was a very genuine, not just sense, obviously, sense of horror after 9/11, but a very deep sympathy for the Americans, and even the idea of a war on terrorism at that time. But there has been, it may be European wimpishness, it may be resentment, and perhaps to do with what Jack was talking about, the fact that the Americans have taken, it's quite true, of course, the Americans find themselves picking up the pieces from European colonial history or decolonization. And there is, not least on the part of the English, there is an underlying feeling of resentment that the Americans took over from us, but as the global hegemon. There was a real shift of opinion, which I could almost date, between the European and British sense of solidarity for America after 9/11, and then what in Europe was very widely regarded as a fatal phrase, the axis of evil.
Hmm.
That was attributed, as it happens, I think, correctly to one of the said ideologists.
An overzealous speechwriter, we hear.
In the White House. And it caused enormous distress in Europe because, you see, it seemed to apply. It was a silly phrase because it, are Iraq, Iran, and North Korea all evil? Yes, they certainly are. Are they an axis? No.
And Europe knows something about an axis. Jeffrey Wheatcroft, standby. Imran is on the line. Welcome, Imran. You're on the air.
Hi. You know what? I have three quick points. One is that I think that probably what Europe brings that America lacks is a long perspective of history, in the sense that it borders the Middle East on its southern border. And,
okay, so they've got history, and we know that.
They've got history on one side, and so that's they bring that long view. I think I'd like to take issue with what Jack said, which was that, you know, America had come up and cleaned up the mess of European colonialism.
Or maybe trying.
Yeah, I would disagree with that. I would say that we basically adopted the mantle of it. I mean, if you look at what we did in Iran by destabilizing the Mossadegh government through the CIA just so that we could not allow Iran to nationalize its oil and then put the Shah in place and, you know, all of that type of stuff, we wouldn't have this situation between Iran and Iraq right now.
Imran, our time is running down, and I want to put that very point to Jeffrey Wheatcroft. How about it, Jeffrey? Do Europeans see the United States as a reluctant global cop or, as Imran would have it, a new brand of imperialist?
Well, if it's not an inadequate answer, both at the same time. I know it may sound like a contradiction, but, I mean, that seems to me perfectly obvious. I mean, clearly, though the word imperial is resented by Americans right across the political spectrum for different reasons, clearly the United States is an imperial power today. It's got forces stationed in 40 different countries, I think. I mean, it is the only superpower on Earth, and it has taken on, whether reluctantly or inexorably because of the forces of history, a role as a superpower trying to sort out and calm the various conflicts of the world. What's very unfortunate is that there are always further complications. I mean, Europeans, again, feel that, to go back yet again to the horrible conflict in the Middle East, I mean, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the Europeans feel, and I'm quoting myself in the New York Times the other month, that there is something paradoxical and even absurd about a country, namely the United States, trying to be an honest broker when it is universally perceived as being committed to one of the sides in that particular tragic conflict.
It's just baked in the cake, in Europe's view.
That's right. Mm. And I think that is a legitimate. There are reasons for this in American history, but nevertheless, it's a legitimate criticism.
Mm-hmm. Jeffrey Wheatcroft, we have to take a short break. I'm sorry, Jeffrey, I've got to jump in. We've got to take a quick break. We're looking at Tony Blair, Britain, and the Europe that says no to America. Whose instincts do you trust more on the war on terror, on Israel and the Palestinians, on Iraq? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Tony Blair, Britain, and the Europe that increasingly, fiercely says no to America. Should European opposition be a wake-up call to Washington or something else entirely? Is Europe too passive? Is America too aggressive? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined tonight by Jeffrey Wheatcroft. He's a distinguished British journalist and historian, and right now by Marilyn. Welcome, Marilyn. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a comment and a question,
okay.
If you'll just bear me out. I'll be as brief as I can be.
Go for it.
I am Jewish and a Zionist. From the beginning, I have been totally opposed to Sharon's policies. I deplore them. And I agree with the Europeans that it would be insanity to attack Iraq. However, I'm very troubled by the European outrage, the anti-Israeli outrage, because we know the history, the searing history of anti-Semitism in Europe, which I'm afraid may be just below the surface. After all, it was Great Britain that was given the mandate and tried in every way to prevent the establishment of a Jewish state. The French have never been particularly friendly, etc. So that's my comment. My question is that I'm bewildered on the issue of Saddam Hussein. On NPR, in fact, the other day, Terry Gross interviewed the man who wrote Black Hawk Down, who said he went to interview or to find out about Saddam Hussein as a dove, and that now he feels we only have a small window before maybe 2 or 3 or 4 years before Saddam Hussein tries to destroy whatever he can.
So, Marilyn, you're bewildered why Europe doesn't want to go after Saddam Hussein.
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I'm not.
Where's your bewilderment?
My bewilderment is actually I would like the Europeans on your show to speak to the problem, the dilemma that I have, and I think many people have, who have been reading articles about this in The New Yorker, in The American Prospect, wherever, that Saddam Hussein and even Iran are presented as being extraordinarily dangerous to the West, not because they're going to attack us as states, but because as states they will develop weapons that they will give to terrorist groups. And so the Bush administration says, so we've got to get rid of them.
What's your question, Marilyn?
And my question is, what do we do? I mean, I am so opposed. I think it would be so incredibly dangerous for us to go in and to attack Iraq with unforetold consequences.
And yet there's the potential threat. Marilyn, I'm going to break in here because I want to get Jeffrey Wheatcroft's response, and these are two very good questions. I'm sure many people have them on their mind, Jeffrey Wheatcroft. First of all, let's go straight at this issue of anti-Semitism in Britain and in Europe. How would you gauge it? We saw European synagogues burning in France last week, and as Marilyn says, there is a long tradition here. What's your interpretation of how anti-Semitism figures into Europe's view of Israel, and would you contrast that with how Israel's seen in the United States?
Well, I cannot, as a European, put my hand on my heart and deny that there's any truth in that. I think there is some. I think that as we all piously say, anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism are not necessarily the same thing, but then they can sometimes overlap. And just as 100 years, and not just on the right politically, 100 years ago, in the days of what was called anti-Semitism as the socialism of fools, there was a most vehement tradition of Jew hatred on the European left, which took the ostensible form of anti-capitalism. Now it sometimes takes the form of anti-Zionism. And clearly if you have burning synagogues in France, you cannot deny that anti-Semitism is an important and very repellent factor, though almost certainly the wave of anti-Jewish attacks in France have been from Islamists, which is not to say that they're
Algerians or others.
Yeah, which is not to say that makes it any nicer, but it's not necessarily the same thing as the old French Catholic right wing of the anti-Dreyfusers.
But does this thread of anti-Semitism mean that the U.S. should discount Europe's view on Israel?
I don't think it does. I mean, you see, you can't. But then having said all of that, which I wanted to be scrupulous about, I don't think you can really simply dismiss all European sympathies, views on that broader Middle East question ranging from Iraq to Israel-Palestine as some sort of transferred manifestation of anti-Semitism. I mean, Tony Blair himself would be quite sure, and I have had many, many criticisms of this man, but he doesn't think he's got an anti-Semitic bone in his body. He has called himself publicly a Zionist, and yet he moves much more towards the Palestinian position, not supporting crazy suicide bombers, but there is a much deeper sympathy for the Palestinians in Europe than there is in America. And the Europeans, for their part, I mean, I'm glad that Marilyn brought this up, because although it's a painful subject, it ought to be addressed. On the on the American side, or not just the Jewish American side, there is a tendency to say, mm-hmm. look, this is just ancestral Jewish, ancestral European anti-Semitism. On the European side, even among civilized and intelligent people, there is a tendency to say, look, the strength of the Jewish lobby and the pro-Israeli lobby in Washington and to some extent in the American media is enormous and conditions the American political response to this conflict. And the two accusations are not neither. It is possible there is something in both accusations, of course, on both sides.
Mm. That's more than we're going to untangle in this hour, but I'm glad we got into it a bit. And Marilyn, thanks for that. Marilyn had one other good question. As much as anyone might not want to go to war with Iraq, there is the unending talk of development of weapons of mass destruction there. How does Europe see that problem?
Europe takes that very seriously, and nobody should have, and most people do not have any illusions about Saddam and the fact that he is a murderous madman. But even that is by no means necessarily an argument for what a lot of people in the Bush administration want to do, which is to have a military attack on him. I mean, the guy may already have some hideous capacity with weapons of mass destruction, and the moment he is perhaps most likely to use them would be if he's pushed into a corner or if he thinks he's about to be destroyed.
Jack Beattie, I want to ask you just quickly, if Jeffrey Wheatcroft, in what you hear from him tonight, were sitting in Crawford, if he were Tony Blair, do you think these are persuasive views for the ears of our President George W. Bush?
I think it will come to him as a kind of education. Earlier, Jeffrey spoke of the clash of civilizations between Europe and America, and this is, of course, a classic story. It's in the novels of Henry James,
mm-hmm.
and in Bush, we have the American concern with black and white. There's evil and there's good. And, of course, the characteristic fault of that is hypocrisy. And on the European side, you have sophistication, worldliness, it's gray, and the characteristic fault of that is cynicism.
Hmm.
So I think it's very difficult for President Bush, given his background and given what people have told him is one of his strengths, his ability to simplify things and to get right to the essence and to call evil, evil, and good, good. I think it's very difficult for him to hear this kind of, on the one hand, on the other hand, if you do that, and to hear this mixture going back and forth. But I think, in that sense, he does represent the red on our map. You know, we had a red and blue map the night of the election, and the blue was on the coast.
We're talking red meat America.
Red and blue, and he is the red America. Mm. These things in, you know, Europeans are too sophisticated and too wily, and Americans are the virtuous people, and we see things. So it's a tough one, I think, for President Bush.
Mm. Jack, Jeffrey, stand by. Peter is on the line. Welcome, Peter. You're on the air.
Yeah, I wanted to inject a note that when we talk about some ectoplasmic shape called Europe, it really is a great many things. And as someone married to a European with many of my children studying in Europe, mm-hmm. I find that a great many Europeans do share the American view, even if some of the elites do not, that some of them realize that after World War II, the United States organized, got Europe economically back on its feet and organized resistance to what turned out to be a serious threat,
mm-hmm.
Soviet communism, and that the threat now is militant Islam, which, if one studies it and does not ignore its tenets, threatens not just the obvious case of Israel, whatever its dimensions, but quite a number of other places in the Philippines and Indonesia and around the world.
Peter, you raise a good point. Our time is running down. I want to put it to Jeffrey Wheatcroft, and I thank you for bringing it in here. Jeffrey Wheatcroft, I hesitate because you are no doubt part of the elite that Peter's referring to.
But I trust not. But
well, anyway. Well, I wonder. But if we can dig beneath that, how uniform is this unhappiness with Washington's policies right now in Europe? Is this a kind of an upper crust or a chattering classes view, or does it go deep into European populations?
I think that's a very good question, which we do not seriously have time to answer at the moment. The point is a good one. In my own country, having been talking about the clash of civilizations, this question, which has been debated a great deal in the politically conscious classes in England for years now, should we side with America or should we side with Europe? And it is, among other things, a cultural question, and it is, among other things besides that, a class question, because the chattering classes, who tend to be pro-European, watch Italian movies and read French novels and have their holidays in Tuscany, and the English people have their holidays in Florida and watch American TV and American movies. And and one should never, I couldn't agree more, one should not assume that there is the anti-Americanism, if you like, of papers like The Guardian and The Observer in England is necessarily representative of the whole country. But I mean, there are, when the speaker a moment ago said that many Europeans are conscious of what we owe the Americans, of course that's true. And when he says that the Americans helped defeat Hitler and then organize the Atlantic Alliance against Russia, absolutely. But one always has to add, like Groucho Marx, the reverse is also true. And anybody who wants to read the new biography by Robert Skidelsky of John Maynard Keynes will be reminded that the Americans, to some extent, went out of their way to destroy Great Britain economically during and after the Second World War.
There was matter, too.
This is how great powers behave. It's not an accusation of special wickedness.
Let's try and get one more call in. Guy is on the line. Guy, welcome. You're on the air. Be brief if you can. Our time is running down.
Sure. The point that I would like to raise is that, is it possible that this conflict is not a conflict of ideals, but more about economy, more about getting a market share, more about oil, more about the European agenda versus the American agenda, and who's going to have greater influence in the Arab world, which is going to result in better contracts and more money?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. Let me put it straight to you, Jeffrey, and our time is going. But is this about mercantile interests in the Middle East or something else?
Well, the European powers, the European Union, which incidentally, to touch very, very quickly on something that was said already, the European Union is not the United States of Europe and shows no signs of becoming the United States of Europe in any foreseeable future. But Europe does have a deep lying economic rivalry with the United States, and it's being fought on both sides. Here, we have here President Bush, to whom I have sometimes. For whom I've expressed sympathy, especially since September 11th, and who claims to be an exponent of, I mention this because of the question of the economy coming up, claims to be a great supporter of free trade. And you wouldn't know that if you were a European steel worker who's just had these tariffs slapped on by the...
Well, we got that, but our time is going. And what about it? Is it commercial interest that the Europeans are, to use Jack Wirtz, cynically pursuing in the Middle East, or would you reject that?
I think there's, as always, there's an element of truth in that, but I do think it goes beyond that.
Jeffrey Wheatcroft, our time has flown too past, too fast, past the thingamajig. But we want to thank you. It's really great of you to come on. I hope we can catch you again sometime, maybe next time from London.
Well, that would be very nice indeed, and thanks very much indeed for the conversation.
Thanks for coming on. Jeffrey Wheatcroft is a British journalist and historian. He's author of The Controversy of Zion, Jewish Nationalism, the Jewish State, and the Unresolved Jewish Dilemma. Jack Beatty, we leave this conversation with a lot of unresolved dilemmas for George W. and Tony to pick up in Crawford.
No, we do, and I think we get a sense of the sort of deep background of that conversation. That there are two civilizations represented here. They have a lot in common, but their histories are very different. And Bush represents a fresh part of the country for Mr. Blair and for Europe. So there's a gulf, but there's also a bridge. Bismarck said that the great geostrategic fact of the modern age was that the Americans spoke English.
But as you say, Jack, I can't really feel George W. Bush responding to a lot of this. It sounds just a little bit too sophisticated. And I don't mean that in a disparaging way, but he's shown he likes the simple path out of conflict.
Yeah.
Strong and simple.
He likes good and evil, and this isn't what he's going to be hearing.
Jack, thanks so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.